You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
It is, and it's going to be, 86 degrees today, which is a very pleasant, almost exactly average high temperature for this time of year.
But between last time we were here and this time that we're here, it was 100 a couple days. We had a little mini heat event.
Yes, we had one of our typical heat waves. I was looking back at some of my old calendar notes from way back when we first set up the website, and I had a note in the month of May that says, usually first 100 degree temperature this month. Well, we skated through May without getting to 100 degrees, but in early June, we did hit 100 degrees one or two days. And then, of course, we're back into our typical pattern here of warm spells interspersed with Delta breeze, which is what makes this side of the valley so lovely. Today's temperature, by the way, it's June 17, 2026, for broadcast on June 18, 2026. We're just a couple days away from the longest day of the year. It's 86 degrees today. 55 degrees will be tonight's low. Thursday will be 82 and sunny. Thursday night will be 55 and clear. Juneteenth will be 78 and sunny. Friday night will be 53 and mostly, did you hear that? 78. Okay. Friday night will be 53 and mostly clear. Saturday, 82 and sunny. Saturday night, 53 and clear. No clouds basically anywhere in the horizon. Sunday, 86 and sunny. Sunday night, clear, 53. Monday, 86 and sunny. Monday night, clear, 53. And then finally bouncing back up to 90 on Tuesday with a heating trend coming mid part of next week. So we've got a full week of weather in the low to mid 80s with nights in the low to mid 50s, which is what we like to call absolutely perfect ideal gardening weather. So for the folks who are coming in, frantic, I never got my vegetables planted. Are there any vegetable plants left? Is it too late?
This is the perfect time.
It's a great time. This weather is ideal. Yes. And you can continue planting all the things you're thinking of. But also, this is when we really plant in a big way. Okra, pumpkins, winter squash, some of those real heat lovers. Well, they're getting what they need. The soil is definitely warm enough for them, but it's nice transplanting weather as well. When it's really hot, the most common question we get as someone is purchasing young vegetables or flowers or something, should I plant these now, wait till tonight, set them in the shade, you know, wait till it's cooler? Those are all fine. I'm just concerned with people trying to hold things in containers because that takes a lot of water. So as we said last week, probably better for you to get them in the ground and just water them there. But this is ideal. You go out in the early evening, you plant something, you water it in, going into 3 or 4 days of temperatures in the low to mid 80s couldn't be better. And transplant shock is what we used to call the drooping period that this little seedling goes through for the next day or so after you transplant it. It's just a couple days. It's really just a day or so of the sudden shock of having done some root tearing like we want you to do, you know, breaking up the roots, spreading them out when you put it in, watering it in, having it go through that first day or so of recovering the roots. Generally, my experience is about 3 to 4 days in, those plants have bounced back and they're ready to go as long as you water them correctly. For those who want to hold them in containers, during that heat event we had, it wasn't really a heat wave, we would come into the nursery, water everything in smaller pots as soon as we arrive. Water many of them again in the early afternoon and water many of them again before we leave at the end of the day. So I think about people asking if they should keep them in their pots. And my question I want to ask is, do you go to work? Do you leave your house for 8 hours at a time? You'll be gone.
Or do you get fallen into the computer and forget to go outside when it's hot?
Right. Well, there's that too. Yes. But if you're not even physically present, then it may be a challenge. One little hint I like to make, and I do this, the last thing I do before I leave my garden at the end of the day is I fill the watering can and leave it sitting near the little plants that are still in containers. So in the morning, I always make a quick circuit through the vegetable garden so I can yell at the turkeys. I make a quick circuit past the young seedlings. And if one of them needs water, I got a watering can right there. I can water it and go, and I don't have to, haul out a hose and, make a
Because
big
you, after all, do go to work.
I do go to work, yes, and they're in the ground. So if I water them thoroughly in the morning, right before leaving on a hot day, they're still got adequate water when I get home. But if they're sitting in a pot, it's very common for me to get home and they're droopy. So easier in the ground. But anyway, lovely weather coming up for this week, and just bouncing back into slightly higher temperatures next week. We are officially now in El Nino. We'll talk about that a little bit more.
Wait a minute, wait. I thought El Nino, what is a winter thing? This is June. How
El
can we be
Niño, El Niño is a warming of ocean temperatures that is going to cause particular effects in the winter. And the climate
ah.
folks who monitor this, they use those really important buoys and monitors that are out in the ocean, and they're monitoring the temperature to see what the anomaly is compared to average temperatures. Is that mass of warmer water moving across the ocean and so forth? And there are metrics they use for determining when we're officially in El Nino. There is the spring issue that they're always very reluctant to declare El Nino, even when the numbers seem to be going in that direction in the spring, because spring is variable. And so they've had the issue that you can't really make a decision in March, April, May, even if it looks pretty strongly like we're going towards a strong El Nino. Well, we're there. We're in June. National Weather Service, NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have said we are in El Nino. And this is what they like euphemistically to call a super El Nino. That's what you're going to see in the news reports about this. One of the strongest anomalies they've seen going to be potentially a very strong, highly impactful El Nino event. And that has worldwide implications. So we're in it now, and we're going to see how strong it gets. And it looks like it's going to be, what's the term the young people use? Epic. It's going to be epic.
So have we had one of these super El Niños before that we
We
know of?
have.
I mean, have we lived through one?
Yeah, you and I actually have here. There have been a few. I don't think there's been one quite this big an anomaly at this stage. 2015, 16 was, 1982, 83 was. I went back and looked at some of my old records since we opened our nursery in 1981, August of 81, winter of 81.
82, 82, that
Right.
was wet.
So we opened in 81, and we were too new to really bring in the winter stuff. We didn't have, the bare root fruit trees and roses. We just kind of got through that one. So 82, 83 was our first real winter in business. Bare root fruit trees, bare root roses, all that stuff. So I went back to my old records, and I also went to the Simis weather station to see how those super El Niños played out. In October of 1982, on one day in October of 1982, we had 10 and a half inches of rain.
Wait a minute, one day?
One day, one major atmospheric river. That
Wow.
was what was recorded at the Davis Weather Station, over 10 inches of rain in a single day. And I remember that because this is the days before we had the internet or cell phones or anything. So you got your weather news from either local radio or a weather radio. We had a weather radio. My partner and I were standing around the shop listening, watching it pour. Nobody's coming into the nursery, obviously, in that kind of condition. And we're listening and casually mentioned it. Interstate 80 has been closed near Fairfield. All right, if you folks know the area, well, it's 30 miles to the west. Interesting. They're closing the major interstate. A few minutes later, Interstate 80 is now closed near Vacaville. That's another 15 miles closer to us. My business partner at the time lived on the other side of Sacramento. He drove a Volkswagen Bug, and he looked at me and he said, "If I want to get home, it seems I should probably leave now." He
So he had
had
to go east,
to go
not
east
west.
ahead of them
Okay.
closing the freeway. And he got to the Yolo Causeway. If you all know the Yolo Causeway, they had not yet widened it. It was two lanes total on each side and no shoulder. So basically, if you went off, congratulations, you're now in the Sacramento River. And he drove along in his Volkswagen Bug. I joked with him, those float, right? Everything should be fine. And he said the water was lapping at the edge of the causeway, and they did close the causeway. So that was an epic event, a single major storm. And then if you're looking back at some of the others, 1991, 92, we had 8.5 inches of rain in February 1992, which is 3 times normal. 1997, 98 was a very strong El Nino here. We remember that one very well. We had a lot of rain in the fall, and then we had 12 inches of rain in February 1998. 12 inches of rain. We normally get about 3 to 3.5. So, and the same pattern in 2016, 17, 2015 looked like it was going to be a super El Nino, kind of fizzled out. We go, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. And then the next year we had substantial rainfall, including 11 inches of rain in January of that year. What really happens with these here in Northern California, at least based on my experience and looking back at this data, is we'll get some really super atmospheric river storms. It's not that every day is rainy. All of that did happen in 82, 83. The rain went from October all the way into May. But more typically, what you get is normal rainfall, normal rainfall. Oh my God, here comes an atmospheric river and it just dumps rain on us. And that's when you get 10 inches in a single day. We had an atmospheric river in October just a couple of years back that gave us 6 inches of rain in October, which is not, that doesn't happen here normally. We normally get 1 inch. So that will lead to flooding. That's way too much water coming down all at once for our soil to absorb it. It's going to go into the streams and then you'll get the stream runoff and you'll get localized flooding. And if you get 10 inches, you'll get more than just localized flooding. So we can anticipate some pretty major atmospheric river events here in Northern California. You can join the Caterit Live Dirt crew as they broadcast live from the 14th Annual Davis Music Festival, featuring performances by Anime, Betty Masenko, and Maita. That's all happening at Armadillo Music, 207 F Street between 2nd and 3rd Streets on Saturday, June 20, starting at 3 p.m. If you can't join them there at Armadillo, just listen live on KDRT 95.7 FM in Davis and Caterit.org worldwide. The Davis Music Fest runs Friday, June 19 through Sunday, June 21, with performances by more than 40 bands on 8 stages across Davis. The event benefits the Davis School Arts Foundation. For more information, just visit davismusicfest.com. Okay, here are a series of questions. We'll just go through these because they're all pretty quick and some of them are fun, so there's not really an answer to them, but it's right in front of you there, Lois. You
Oh
can read it.
my
Try
goodness.
not to laugh as we go through some of these.
Oh, I can't not laugh. The
Okay, here.
first one is, do you sell chickens? The internet said you did. What? And then a week later, somebody came in, do you sell turkeys? What, why is the internet saying you sell chickens and turkeys?
I don't know, but just for the record, nope, we don't sell chickens and we don't sell turkeys. I know we are a barn, our building is a barn, and I can't think what internet website thinks that the Redwood Barn Nursery sells chickens or turkeys. Not a bad idea, maybe we will, but not right now.
And maybe they heard you talking on the radio about the turkeys right outside your
There you
yard, but
go.
that's on his farm out
Sure
in
as
the
heck
country.
wouldn't sell turkeys based on my experience with them. Scrolling down here to with basil, what was this one?
Okay, so is this like the only kind of Persian cucumber you'll be getting?
Okay, so Persian cucumber is actually a category of cucumber. It's not a particular variety. There's several forms of cucumber that are in that category. They're generally picked small. They're very tender. They're very sweet. Those you've seen those bags of little baby cucumbers in the grocery store. Those are apparently a type of Persian cucumber, or at least that was what I was told years ago. They may be special varieties that are grown just for that particular end of agribusiness at this point. Persian cucumbers are very good. I highly recommend them. You do need to keep on them, keep picking them. Diva is probably the best known variety, but there's several others that are out there. And we probably stock 6 different kinds of Persian cucumbers at any given time. Why? Because they're never bitter. One of the things I like about Persian cucumbers, burpless cucumbers, lemon cucumbers, and that thing that isn't a cucumber called Armenian cucumber, is that they're never bitter. Whereas your common salad cucumbers, the ones you're thinking of, the slicing cucumbers, we have a real problem with the fruit being bitter here. I've given up on them completely. I don't grow regular green cucumbers at all anymore. I would read when I was first getting into gardening that, oh, they're bitter because of irregular watering or something. Well, no, it's just a heat
They're
thing.
bitter because they're not grown, because they're grown in California.
Well, not California, because they're grown here in the valley where it gets hot, because it's a high
Right.
temperature thing. They're fine in coastal zones, they're fine in cooler parts of California. My experience with them is when I've grown regular green slicing cucumbers, Everything goes along fine. Then we have a heat wave, and no matter how well I watered the plant, the next fruit are bitter. So it appears to be related to that. The bitterness in cucumbers is common in the entire family, and it's been selectively bred out of them for the ones that we eat, but stress will induce that bitterness. Doesn't happen on the Persians. Doesn't happen on the Armenian, which is not a cucumber at all. It's really a type of melon, believe it or not. Doesn't happen on the lemon cucumbers. Doesn't happen on the purple. So the answer is no, we'll have several other varieties. More to the point, the reason I left this in here for this week, we can keep planting cucumbers all the way through to the middle of the summer, because a cucumber plant planted now will be fruiting in about 30 days or less. So you have plenty of time here to continue planting cucumbers, even from seed, if you're inclined to do that. What's next?
So Don, you just said something that I really like. Stress may induce bitterness.
Yes.
And that's true of people as well as cucumbers.
So our garden quote for the day is stress induces bitterness. Plant the right kind of cucumber.
I like it. Let's use that one. Okay. Right. So someone came in and was looking at the roses, and they were looking at roses that are planted in a 1 gallon pot and asking, is this the smallest size you get?
Okay, so that's kind of funny.
I'm thinking that maybe they're thinking of, oh, when you go to Trader Joe's or something, and you get these little tiny, small bushes of roses, and they're in a little tiny pot, but they're not meant for indoors. And so, yeah.
No, this well, is a, it was a good question because that was actually what they were thinking of. They had seen the little miniature roses in quart pots or 4-inch pots, probably at the grocery store, Trader Joe's. You know, we were always mentioning them. I'm not dumping on them. They just sell a lot of interesting and weird plants. Always have them. So does our local Nugget grocery store. They're getting them from a company in the coastal areas, Rocket Farms, who does an outstanding job of what we call indoor color. People buy them as an indoor plant and enjoy them indoors, but they're not intended to be kept indoors. So they're like a long-lasting bouquet. As long as you treat it that way, great. Now, I want to mention those because those roses, no, we don't sell them. We might propagate our own and do them someday. But these companies do a really good job. They've selected some miniature roses or very compact growing roses. They're propagating them from cuttings, and so they're on their own roots. They're not grafted. And they're going right into a quart pot, which is a little bigger than a 4-inch pot. And they can sell them in bloom at about 6 inches tall. I've seen these. I've bought some of them. There'll be a color that I haven't seen before. Just so you know, if you put those in your garden, they're hardy, tough, adaptable rose bushes. They're good. They're good garden plants. That's actually
how big do they get though?
Mostly 3 feet, roughly 3 by 3. So they are compact for a rose. They're very bushy. I'm not quite sure what the parentage is. At some point, I'll try and dig into this a little bit more because miniature roses were a big thing in the 70s and 80s. There was one breeder who really, really did a lot of work on miniature roses, and there was a long period of popularity. And the florist industry and the houseplant industry picked up on that. But they're not using those better-known miniature roses. These are strains that have been selected primarily for this particular market. But they are good garden plants. If you put them in the ground, they'll turn into a shrub about the size of an India hawthorn, if that gives you some basis for comparison. Smaller than a typical rose bush. They're clustered blooming. They bloom like crazy. I don't know about the full-on disease resistance because they haven't been bred or selected for that, but some of them probably are and some of them probably aren't. The main thing is that's the best thing to do with those if you buy them, is to put them out in the garden in a sunny location or at least in a very big container, because even miniature roses have big roots. This is an important thing to know. They don't stay in a 4-inch or quart pot for very long. You better put it up in at least a 12-inch pot if you're going to try and grow it in a container. And by late summer, that plant will be needing water every single day. So even better would be to go up to maybe a 14 or 16-inch pot.
Or the ground.
And in either case, you'll have a nice garden plant. And that's the best way to look at those. A 1 gallon size, what we thought was amusing about this is finding roses in a 1 gallon, common roses like Double Delight or Peace or whatever. It's really unusual. We're just doing that because we had a little bit of a surplus for our program of putting them into 2s, 3s, and 5 gallons. So we set them out in 1 gallon. You're not typically going to find roses in 1 gallon containers in most nurseries. But if you are attracted to them at those fascinating displays at the funny grocery store, house plant, color, melange that they come up with at most of the grocers, what you might call the high-end or specialty grocers, don't hesitate to buy them. Just be aware of what you're getting. You're getting an outdoor plant you're going to enjoy for a while in a container and perhaps put outside later. As we've said many times about these plants, they're not indoor plants. Azaleas are not indoor plants. Most of those flowering things are just something you can enjoy for a few weeks and then plant outside. And that certainly goes for the miniature roses. But I've been real impressed with the vigor, the bloom consistency, the quality of these miniature roses they're selling.
Let's go to this one. I've had this little tree for all these years, and all of a sudden it's covered with these little things. What are they? Bugs or something? Are they going to take over? Did they give you a picture?
Yeah, this is a mulberry, and those are the fruit. Those are the fruit. All right, next question was.
What happens? Are they going to become new plants when they hit the ground?
Well, unless you eat them. I mean, we grow mulberries.
You can eat
the fruit. Yes, you can eat mulberries. All right. Now, I have to say, many of the mulberries, all the mulberries that we sell are actually seedless. So they're parthenic carpet. You don't have to worry about them reseeding. There are mulberries that do reseed. And one of the most commonly planted in the past, the white mulberry, reseeds quite a bit. But black mulberries, Morris nigra, the varieties that we sell, Pakistan mulberry, they're parthenocarpic, which simply means that they set fruit without pollination. They don't need to be, they set fruit. It doesn't matter that they pollinate. They don't make seeds. And so the fruit is seedless, which is a great bonus. And consequently, those, Pakistan mulberry, black mulberry, do not reseed. The white mulberry, Morris alba, the male version is planted. It's a dioecious tree. The male one is planted as a fruitless shade tree, and it's very popular for that reason. It's a huge, spreading, very deep shade tree. That's the male, so it's obviously not going to fruit. But the female of that does fruit rather heavily and reseeds quite a bit. You only need one of those in a neighborhood for everybody to have white mulberries coming up all around the place. But the black mulberry, Morris nigra, and the Pakistan mulberry, which are great garden plants, do not have seed. However, what she saw were fruit. She'd never seen mulberry fruit before. They look kind of like blackberries, or in the case of the Pakistan mulberry, like sort of red caterpillars.
So it's a tree that she's had for many years, and she never had fruit on it before. Is that typical for mulberry?
No, they typically fruit pretty quickly. She probably has never noticed them before. That's our best guess. But they're
and
delicious.
That would be because the birds ate them all.
Yes, indeed. Your biggest competition with mulberries is going to be other things eating them. Mulberries are really easy to grow. I mean, and some of them are huge and require a lot of pruning, but a lot of them are very compact. I have Morris nigra, the black mulberry. Mine was sold as Persian mulberry. And these are headed up, I should say, grafted up high. So they're 6 foot up off the ground. That's where they chose to put the tree head. And in 30 years, that plant has gotten about 12 feet total with about a 12 foot spread. I have two of them. And so that's a manageable size. You can reach a lot of the fruit. I have a Pakistan mulberry, which in less than 10 years is already hitting 15 or 20 feet and shows signs of wanting to go at least double that. So we're going to start pruning that one pretty severely. Thing you need to know about mulberries is that the black mulberries, Morris nigra, the fruit stains, the juice, they burst as you pick them. So it's a messy operation. The fruit stains your hands and everything. Fun project for kids. Just plan on hosing them off when they're done. Okay. And they're quite delicious. But the first time you eat a mulberry, you'll be a little surprised because it looks like a blackberry, but doesn't have the tartness at all. No tang. It's all sweet. Pretty mild flavor compared to what it looks like. So people are often a little surprised, but you have more fruit than you could ever possibly deal with. They are very, very heavy producers, kind of all at once in the case of the Pakistan mulberry, over several weeks in the case of the black mulberry. That would sound desirable, except that about 5 to 7 days in, the jays and the mockingbirds will discover them, which is cool, but it becomes an incredible mess wherever they are, because not only do you now have mulberries falling on the ground and causing stain, the digestive system of the birds is affected, and they are causing stains in a lot of other places nearby. So black mulberry is not something for a clean, fastidious yard. It's something for a more rural property. If you want a mulberry that does harvest easily, doesn't make a squishy mess, the Pakistan mulberry is a great choice. There's a bunch of cultivars of that. However, they are bigger trees. They do need a lot more pruning. If you want to see a great website that gives more information than you can possibly imagine about mulberries, one of our Davis active participants in the Sacramento area, rare fruit growers. Her website is reallygoodplants.com, and she propagates and sells propagation stock, but also does YouTube videos of her different fruit and has, I don't even know how many varieties of mulberries, and they're really easy to grow. So if you're interested in mulberries, check out her site, reallygoodplants.com. You'll get information. And if you want to buy stuff, well, they certainly sell cuttings as well.
Can indoor potting soil be used for potted plants on an outside patio?
Yes.
All right. Now, this question is an interesting one to me. It says,
Sorry.
well, I got
Sorry.
rid of
There you go.
that. What is the most inert soil you have?
Not quite sure what he meant by that, but we just said probably our topsoil, because it does have
And
anything,
how
doesn't
much
it?
does it cost?
It was $10 a bag.
Oh, and what's the runner-up? I love this. This is someone who obviously watches the America's Test Kitchen.
What's the
Yeah.
runner-up? So
Yeah.
I'm not sure what they meant by inert soil. Well, they just basically didn't want soil with a bunch of stuff added to it. Okay, well, that's going to be topsoil, most likely. When a
So
company puts topsoil in a bag, I'm never quite sure exactly what that means, but hopefully it's clean.
it isn't sterile, though. I mean,
No.
if it says inert and he means sterile.
Nothing you buy for soil use at a nursery is sterile. And boy, has that been a tough myth to overcome. You can thank Rod McClellan Company, that was acres of orchids in San Mateo, South San Francisco, sold orchids like crazy, but also happened to invent a product called Super Soil. And that product called Super Soil was so popular for many years. When we opened, you had to have Super Soil if you were a retailer. And he claimed it was sterile because during the process of getting it through the mixing and then ending up in the conveyor and going into the bags, they ran it over a steam jet. Right, so you had high temperature steam blasting for 1 second on the potting soil. Did that sterilize it? No, of course it did not sterilize it, but they essentially made a claim that it was, quote, steam sterilized, end quote. We literally had people walking in because we carried a different product, like, is this sterile? No, and neither is his. That was essentially a false claim. No offense, Rod. You did a lot for the industry. You made orchids cheap, and you came out with a product that became so popular it became a generic name. People would refer to potting soil as super soil, and vice versa, because it was so popular. There is no such thing as sterile soil, and you don't want totally sterile soil. You just want soil that's not going to make conditions favorable for the growth of water molds. And that means it's going to have more aeration. It's going to be made of things that don't naturally support the growth of water molds, like peat moss, perlite, vermiculite. They're not natural. They're not sterile per se, but they don't provide the food substrate that those organisms would need to live on. So they're naturally kind of sterile-ish. And it's also been known for a long time that peat moss, and especially sphagnum moss, have some antifungal properties. So that would be helpful if you're, say, starting seeds. That would be a useful thing to know. If you really need sterile soil, you sterilize soil. You cook it in the oven. I recommend you have the family leave for the morning when you do that.
So, Don, would you explain how having a saucer under your pot of your house plants, how that works? What is it?
We didn't understand the question. Whenever someone buys a house plant from us, we give them a saucer to go with it. That's part of the price, because we learned a number of years ago that a lot of college students in particular would buy a house plant and wouldn't know what to do at that point. If I set this on the piano, isn't it going to stain the piano? I said, yeah, you need a saucer. Oh, I have to buy a saucer. I thought, you know what? It's a 50-cent thing. Let's just make it part of the price and give them a saucer when they buy it. And it's amazing how people think that's like the most generous thing they can imagine. So then the question would be, okay, so how does this work? And I said, well, what do you mean? You put it under the plate, you set the pot in the saucer. Okay, and then, oh, I see. Okay, so then you put water. They thought, okay, do you put water in the saucer? Well, you could do that, but that's not our preferred method of watering. There are some cases where you encounter that. All right, so when you buy a plant and you take it home, you need to figure out, if this is your first house plant, about how much water does it take to thoroughly water that plant enough that some water will start to show up in the saucer below as you're watering. And that made sense. And then the next question from another new student customer was, about how much is that? Okay, so, well, from my experience, it's about a cup of water for a 6-inch pot. It's about 2 cups of water for an 8-inch pot, somewhere in that range. It's going to depend on the soil you use. So that's going to make a big difference. It's going to depend on how dry the soil is. Those are variables, but I basically want you to put on half a cup to a cup at once. Does water come out in the saucer below? No. put on another half cup or cup and see. And now you've measured, now you know that roughly once a week, because we're just finding that so simple to say to people, roughly once a week, now you know it takes, in your case, 1 to 1.5 cups of water. Put that on, put on enough until you see some water coming out in the saucer while you're watering. So that is one of the purposes of the saucer, protect your piano. And also it holds the extra water. Then of course, the next question is, what do you do with that extra water? Some of you may be listening in places where it's humid enough, warm enough, muggy, that having water standing around the roots like that, it wouldn't evaporate very quickly. You might end up with some root rot. Here, I pretty much guarantee any normal summer weather conditions, even indoors, that'll evaporate so fast that having a quarter inch of water standing in the saucer for a day or two is not going to be any threat to the plant. But that is something that, you know, the next question is, what do you do with this? Also, I can tell you, it looks pretty gross because we have pretty hard water here at times. And so the salt buildup and the scuzzy stuff in the saucer will be unattractive. So you may wish to set this whole apparatus into another thing, like a basket or something, for appearance's sake. That's really the only reason you would do that. But you got to have something to catch the water, and you got to put in enough water that some of it shows up in the saucer. So we actually explained how it works to water a plant in a vinyl saucer.
Don, I think you should make a video of that.
Davis Garden Show, Davis Garden Show YouTube channel. Is that what we're talking here?
Okay. So now he's overhearing a discussion. And one friend who turns to her friend who supposedly knows a lot about plants says, so should I get potting soil for my plants? And this other friend says,
this is literally what she said. Oh, I just make my own, mix my own substrate, add rat poop.
Maybe she has a rat.
That could be. Rat poop is a perfectly okay source of fertilizer, but I don't really know what the percentage nitrogen is. It's probably about 3% would be my guess. You can make your own potting soil. It's not that hard to do, but most people would find that just buying the materials in order to do it would probably create more soil than you need. So this is the reason nurseries sell soil in different size bags already mixed up for you. We have found even the smallest bag with the market that we have with a lot of college students, you know, they're going to be arriving August, September. They don't even have storage in their dorm room or wherever they're living. So they don't have a place to keep potting soil. They're certainly not going to be making their own potting soil. This was a college age person, but you can. It's generally a mix of sand, peat moss, and compost. That's the basic start for potting soil right there. Sand, peat moss, compost. Now you can substitute. You can use topsoil instead of sand if you have some reason to do that. You can use coir instead of peat moss, or coir and peat moss if you happen to want the benefits or characteristics of either one of those or both. The compost is the biggest factor in any potting soil. And if you're going to choose a compost to make your own potting soil, you better choose that pretty carefully, because some of them are pretty coarse and are really just intended for mulching and for turning into vegetable garden beds. And others are more fine textured and have been literally composted more fully. Most of them aren't going to say compost on the label. They're going to say planting mix or garden soil or something like that. So choose carefully. And if you happen to choose one that has some nutrients in it, great. If not, you better plan on putting some nutrients in, because that's what most potting soils now have. They have some source of plant food in there. This is a little complicated. I've formulated potting soils many, many, many times over the years. So you get to the point, like when I was working in the Botanical Conservatory, where we had these file cards. This is the one for ferns. This is the one for cactus and succulents. This is the one for regular tropicals in the greenhouse that are woody plants. This is the one for herbaceous plants and so forth. We all started with the same basic ingredients: sand, peat moss, compost. And we were feeding with liquid fertilizer, so we didn't add fertilizer, but you can certainly do that one way or another. Slow release types like Osmocote, or organic types like dehydrated chicken manure, can be incorporated in there. Those are all possibilities. You can do all this if you want to. And there might be economic reasons for doing it. Let's say you're doing a lot of plants. All right. Let's say you have 20, 30, 40 house plants that you want to transplant. You might want to make your own. But what they varied by was the proportions and the other little things we would add. So if it was a cactus mix, we would be adding pumice in pretty significant amounts to that sand, peat moss, compost base. We also used a very similar mix with the pumice with leaf mold for ferns, you know, because we wanted not just the fast drainage, but also the long-term organic benefit of the leaf mold. Hard to get leaf mold nowadays. Very fine bark is sometimes used. So there's other things you might add for specific things. And there's a handful of plants where none of this applies. Epiphytes, for example, will just be going into straight bark or bark and pumice, some combination. You already know that if you've gotten up to that level of houseplants. This is like sophomore, junior, senior level of potting soil formulation. But for the basic, what I'll call freshman level, sand, peat moss, or coir, compost with some additives to enhance drainage and provide nutrients. Very similar to what you'll find online as Cornell mix or UC mix. This is the basis of the nursery industry. And then the other additives are things for either faster drainage or water retention or nutrient.
I hear ferns are good for your bathroom because they'll soak up moisture.
What? Ferns are a good choice in the bathroom if your bathroom has light, actual light, like a window. Or a skylight or something like that. Nothing grows in a bathroom that doesn't have natural light. We get this question a lot. Ferns are probably a good choice because they're pretty low light tolerant. In a lot of places in this country, they're actually pretty easy to grow as houseplants. They're a little tricky for us because we're so low humidity in the summer. And the ferns that people really like, the maidenhairs, are probably the least successful indoors here in the valley. But there are ferns that can be grown indoors, Boston ferns, if you're very good at your watering, and many other smaller ferns that are suitable. The soaking up moisture part, no, they don't make much difference in that regard. They do use the moisture, and then they release moisture. So net balance of moisture in the room is not affected by the ferns probably at all.
I heard lavenders could help to deter bugs outside. Are they okay in the shade? Well, let's take two of those questions.
two separate issues.
Are they okay in the shade?
Lavender, no. Really. No, lavender wants full sun. And it
and
loves
deterring bugs.
Okay, this is a thing that's been going around on the internet for 20 years now, that there are certain plants that will repel insects, and they're almost always members of the mint family. When I look at these lists, they're all great garden plants. They're things like lavender, mint. You can look at the list. You can't miss them online. Just us talking about them now, they'll be popping up in my Facebook feed. Yes, it is true that many plants emit volatile organic compounds. That's why we like some of those things, especially members of the mint family. They smell good as you walk by. They smell good if you crush a leaf. Some of them contain citronella compound, like the scented geranium. It's called citrosa. It's loads of it. And many others have, scented geraniums. If you've ever grown them, they have wonderful smelling leaves. And they do emit those little volatile organic compounds. There isn't the slightest evidence that planting those anywhere reduces the insect population of the things you're concerned about. It's usually people who want to do something about flies, mosquitoes, fungus gnats, and they want to plant things in pots and put them near their front door because that'll somehow keep mosquitoes from coming in the house. I have seen that assertion made on memes and Facebook posts and other sources of misinformation. There is no basis for it. There's nothing wrong with planting those plants, but I don't want you to think that they're going to repel mosquitoes in particular. The material in them, that citronella compound, this must be where this comes from. The citronella compound is used in natural repellents. If you ever buy those, rub them on yourself. You'll smell like lemon pledge. And guess what? You won't get bit by mosquitoes until all that stuff evaporates away, which takes 15, 20 minutes. So as long as you keep rubbing them all over yourself, every 15 to 20 minutes, you could repel mosquitoes. And you could do that every time you walk by a plant. Lemon verbena is a good example, or rosemary or something, lavender. But I think one, you might get tired of smelling strongly like herbal remedies. And two, it isn't that effective. The main thing it doesn't do is cause a mosquito flying along to not go in your house. So that's the problem we have with this, is that people come in thinking they're going to solve their bug problem by planting certain plants. Doesn't work that way, but boy, this one will not die. This has been around for a number of years now.
I heard that planting a whole egg under a plant is a good way to apply fertilizer. Now, I'm assuming that they're talking about the whole raw egg, including the shell, which of course has calcium in it. So maybe that's one of those myths that's been out there forever. Yeah. And an egg is protein.
Yeah,
that's got to be good food.
Yeah, it takes a long time for that eggshell to break.
Have you ever heard this? You squish it.
I know they plant the whole raw egg under the plant. Folks, I'm not recommending this, but this one's, I guess, harmless. Okay.
Well, except you'll run out of eggs.
Right. Well, some people who raise their own chickens might have a surplus. Okay. Next one is a little more challenging.
Other than putting a raw egg under your plant, what's the best way to fertilize a new plant, a newly planted plant? Like a little flower or bush or something?
Personally, I plant first and then mulch with something that contains nutrients. That's what I do. That works. Also, for young vegetable seedlings, I will plant there. The soil they're in has nutrients in it, so that's usually all they need. But if I feel a couple weeks later that I want to give them a little boost, I'll take a good soluble fertilizer, and it can be conventional, it can be organic. Fish emulsion is fine. We sell one that's made from corn liquor. That works great. We've been using it in the nursery yard because when we tried to use fish emulsion in the nursery yard,
Smells bad.
it smelled very bad for about 2 days. Yeah. So we decided that we weren't going to do that again, but the other one works well. And of course, the well-known conventional fertilizers work well. I just let things root in a little bit first and make a decision a week or two later.
So this customer came in and showed pictures of a citrus tree that she had bought last year and is clearly drought stressed. And Don's question is, how are you watering? And her answer is, oh, I watered in the winter when it wasn't raining, but then I stopped watering since the rain stopped.
Yeah.
Huh?
Huh, that's kind of what we said. Okay.
Well, I figured it needed some water because we didn't get as much rain as usual, but since the rainy season is over, I stopped.
I said citrus trees need water here during the summer.
They do?
Yeah, so she was essentially going to treat it like a native plant. And even with native plants, you probably need to water them through the first summer. So the idea was that this is something she would water to give it enough water in the rainy season, and then it's like, okay, you're on your own. Symptoms of drought
Wow.
stress, just so you know, are leaves that are curling and cupping. Sunburn on the leaves on the south and west sides will be one stage. A leaf drop will be the next stage. The whole plant will look drooped. The early stage is a loss of gloss to the leaves. The shiny leaves are now dull in appearance. And of course, new growth stops. Those are some of the symptoms of drought stress. Leaves curling can also be a sign of too frequent irrigation and root injury, but that's not as common anymore as it used to be. Let's put it that way. More commonly, what we see is trees that are slowly curling and cupping. We're talking citrus here, curling and cupping their leaves due to insufficient irrigation, either not enough water all at once, or insufficient frequency, or something. So this is the first thing, is knowing what the symptoms of drought stress are.
So I have heard that California has a great climate for growing citrus.
Yeah, and you
So
know what? The
why should
two,
you have to water it
the three
again?
leading counties for citrus production are around Fresno, which are some of the highest value agricultural counties in the world because of their citrus production. They get 10 inches of rain a year in that area. They water those trees, in addition to that 10 inches or so of winter rainfall, 30 to 40 inches during the growing season, like any other orchard. That's what they do for maximum production. There have been significant areas of research in reducing that irrigation because citrus is a pretty high water user the way they were conventionally growing it. And they have found that using a variety of methods, going to drip, for example, or even sub-irrigation, underground irrigation, they can reduce irrigation 10%, 20%, 30%, and still get the same yield. But that doesn't mean they don't irrigate. Otherwise, they wouldn't get any yields. They do water deeply through the summer. They time it carefully for harvest and for bloom and fruit set. And this has been studied to the nth degree, how to use water more efficiently and still get good crops. But they do give typically water from 1st of May through the end of October, early November. Home gardeners should give a deep irrigation to most of their fruit trees, including their citrus, in our area with our soils about every 2 weeks, and a very thorough watering when you do. I mean, 50 gallons plus, 100 gallons on a larger tree. If you can't do that for some reason, you water less than once a week, okay, once a week is fine. That's just great. I would be very happy if most people would water most of their landscape very thoroughly once a week and only give more frequent watering to the flower borders, the vegetable garden, the lawns. Everything else, newly planted plants, you hand water those or individually get water to them. Other than that, well-established landscape plants once a week would be great. Many of the bigger woody plants, fully established every 2 weeks, would be great if you give them a really thorough soaking when you do. And that's the important part, is the little trickle watering we've talked about so many times doesn't come close to what the plants need. I'd rather have you just turn that system on overnight every 2 weeks than have it trickling for 20 minutes every third day. It sounds like a lot of water, but it is all at once, and it's going down to the whole root system, out to the whole root system, keeping the plant growing and producing well.
Do you guys happen to have an organic magnesium calcium that I can add to my soil?
Yeah, he was looking for something very specific, and my guess is he was probably a pot grower because we tend to get these micronutrient questions from people who are growing cannabis. But sometimes it could be tomatoes or other very vigorous annual crops that will show sudden transient nutrient deficiencies. So that was the first point I made was if you see what looks like a magnesium deficiency, it's pretty good chance it'll just outgrow it. Probably weather related. We get big fluctuations in the weather, especially colder nights or extreme temperatures. Suddenly, you'll suddenly have an inability of the root to take up a particular nutrient briefly. You'll see this nutrient deficiency and it just outgrows it. So as with many pest problems, I say monitor, see if the problem is going to solve itself. The reason I say that is that if you are fully organic, it'll be very challenging to find the micronutrients in a form that's going to be usable. The chelated products, which are what you're typically going to find, which are spray on materials, that's conventional, that's not organic. So you won't be able to use those if you're trying to retain full organic, either certification or practices for one reason or another. There are some very slow acting things out there, like Greenol FST, which is a mined product that contains magnesium and things like that. When I say slow acting, I mean very slow acting. These are basically rock dust type products that are mined out of the soil, ground to a very fine powder, applied to the soil, which break down over months, years, really depends on your time span and your soil type and bacterial activity and other things. So that's one way you can go, but I wouldn't count on any kind of a quick corrective from that. But suspect that if you're seeing a sudden transient micronutrient deficiency, it'll probably just correct itself. If you want to correct it and you don't mind going out of the organic options, there are chelated trace elements that you can spray on the plant that will correct these problems pretty quickly.
I'm growing tomatoes and zucchini in 12-inch grow bags. How often will I need to water them, and what fertilizer should I use?
Yeah, it depends on the soil as to what fertilizer you would use. If you bought a good soil that has organic fertilizer in it, probably that'll take care of the whole season. Here's my problem with this. A 12-inch grow bag is basically the size of a 5-gallon nursery container. And in
What's a
our,
grow bag?
oh, it's a, they're just like they sound. They're a fabric bag that you fill with soil and you plant in.
Is that like a burlap
Yeah,
bag type
basically,
of
sort
thing?
of. They're sturdier
Okay.
than burlap. They don't rot as fast as burlap, but yeah, that's the idea. These became very popular with pot growers at one point. A lot of home gardeners started using them because you can get surprisingly large ones that will hold up through at least one or two seasons, especially if you set them up off the ground on, something so there's air movement. And so it's an inexpensive way to get a very large container-like thing. You fill them with soil, but 12 inches for a tomato or a zucchini is not going to be anywhere near big enough for them in our climate. So this gets to a real simple data point that I have found is useful for people. The minimum size, the minimum soil volume that I'm looking for a tomato or a squash or anything is going to be 1.5 cubic feet, 1.5 cubic feet, which is a typical normal size bag of potting soil these days. A 12-inch grow bag will hold less than half of that. And so by mid-July, any tomato plant, any zucchini plant will be root bound. How often will you need to water it? Probably twice a day,
Every day.
at least every day, and probably twice a day. It'll dry out that quickly. These fabric bags breathe moisture, so they dry out pretty quickly. So for people who are doing like large quantities of tomatoes or cannabis or something in their yard, they'll often just put in a water line for these so they can have it run every day for 5 or 6 minutes and hydrate the whole thing. The bigger, the better. Always gardening in the valley, any interior part of California where it's hot and dry in the summertime. The smallest unit that I use myself for these things is a 15-gallon nursery bucket. So that would be the equivalent of about a 16-inch grow bag. And that you could get by with watering once a day, even in hot weather. 12 inch is going to be a real challenge. And it's frustrating when someone does this because my feeling is that this project is going to fizzle out mid to late July after just a couple of instances of not watering sufficiently. The plant will be so set back that they'll just give up on the project. When you start your season, you're going to do them in containers, get the biggest container you can. And get the best quality soil you can, then you're going to get better results because we're in a hot, dry climate where you have to water quite a lot. 12-inch grow bag just isn't going to do it for either of those. Be fine for a pepper or basil. Those would be good things to do in that. You could do a regular, well, I'd probably use one of the compact ones like the spicy globe basil for a pepper plant. Well, they'd be fine. If you do a tomato, look for a determinate one, or even better, some of these miniature ones, the dwarf tomatoes, they would be fine. If you just stuck a better boy, early girl celebrity in there, boy, it's going to be really hard to keep that watered long enough to get some good fruit production from it. Zucchini, well, fine. You know, get it to three or four. You've had your share of zucchini. You're done for the season.
So another customer came in and said, "I see you have semi-dwarf lemons. Do you have dwarf lemons?"
Yeah, we get this a lot. Four Winds Growers, big grower of citrus in California, and they ship through the internet all over, well, not all over the world, but a lot of places that allow them to ship there. For many years, would graft citrus onto a particular very dwarfing version of the flying dragon root stock that caused almost all of the varieties grafted onto it to grow very slowly compared to how fast it would grow. I hope that made sense. So if you grafted onto this very dwarfing root stock, you could promise people that the tree would only get 6, 8, 10 feet. In the case of Meyer lemon, it's already a naturally dwarf tree. So if you did it on there, it could be kept under 5 feet with no problem. I don't know exactly why they stopped using that one, but several years ago, that root stock just went away. And well, I've grown it, and I think I can understand what the problem was. Things grew so slowly on it in some cases that it would just take too long to get a saleable plant. They discontinued it. No one else is doing it. Pretty much all my citrus growers are using the C35 root stock, which is called, quote, semi-dwarf, end quote. That's why they saw that on the label. So the answer is, do you have dwarf lemons? No, there isn't a dwarf lemon anymore. But Meyer lemon, which is not a true lemon, but it's one of California's most favorite lemons. It's considered to be a lemon mandarin hybrid, but it's used like a lemon. Popular backyard lemon tree in California is very slow growing compared to other citrus. And on its own roots, over 10 years, it might get 6 feet. And 10 years, a Washington navel would be 12 feet. So relatively dwarf compared to other citrus. And they're all prunable, so you can manage the size of citrus. True lemons, true dwarf, no longer on the market as far as I can tell anywhere, but you can easily keep some types of citrus smaller, and I would say the Meyer lemon in particular. The real lemons, true lemons like Eureka, Lisbon, the Italian gourmet ones, they're going to try to get to 15 feet plus no matter what, even on a so-called semi-dwarf root stock, and they're pretty thorny. So I wouldn't plant them where any place where you're going to have to prune them for size control, at least not very often. But the Meyer lemon makes a great small citrus that we will go ahead and call dwarf, even though it's not technically dwarf. Do you know what a fishtail palm is?
Nope.
It's a particular type of ornamental palm tree. Caryota, I believe, is the botanical name. I remember them from Southern California. They have big, wide fronds that are quite distinct. The frond sort of vaguely looks like a giant maidenhair leaf, if it makes sense. And they're very dramatic. I remember a lot of them at the San Diego Zoo were planted down there. May still be there decades later, who knows? And brought this in, and it just looked fried. I mean, every bit of the frond was dying back from the edges and from the inside, and it was anemic and it had a scurfy appearance. And she wanted to know if it had thrips or if it had spider mites or if there was a watering problem. And I said, yes, all of the above. It's very, very, very sensitive to water quality. They do get spider mites. I wouldn't be surprised if thrips got on them, and they need a lot of water. So my recollection of these, which are not popular in Northern California, but we run into this occasionally, that we would plant them in very fast draining soils because they need perfect drainage, and then we'd water them all the time. So that's a bad start because that means you're putting them in something that's like 50% pumice. If it goes dry, the plant will show stress. This is a classic case where I could take a Sharpie and take a leaf and draw five different lines on the leaf showing when it dried out, when it didn't get enough water. And I can do that frequently during the summertime. It withers back, oh, a quarter to an eighth of an inch, and then they get water on the plant, so the withering stops. And then they go too long before the next watering, so it resumes. And you get these marked lines on the leaf showing these drought episodes. So I could see that that had happened. You aren't going to be able to manage the watering in our climate very readily because of how dry and hot we are here and what kind of soils they usually put them in. If the soil is too dense to retain moisture, they rot. So it's a fussy tree. I wouldn't personally ever sell a fishtail palm, and it's kind of what I ended up saying. I was able to identify at least 3 to 4 episodes of drought, each of which caused some of the dieback. Water that contains salt, I remember this part from San Diego because the water there had a lot of salt content. And the salt would pass all the way through the leaf to the edge and then accumulate and cause a burnt look on the edge, usually the end first and then around the edge of the leaf. And it was very common in Davis back years ago when we had shallower well water. We were on a different water supply now, but we used to run into this all the time, was the salt burn on the edges of the leaf as well. This person happened to actually be out in the country, not in town. I didn't know that when we started the conversation. So they're on well water. So that's probably a factor. If they have a water softener, that's lethal to plants. You'll know right away if you have a problem with that, because that's replacing calcium with sodium, which accumulates very quickly and the plant looks very, very burnt. So don't use water from a softener if you happen to have a water softener. And she said, what about nitrate? And when I learned that she was out in the country, I said, well, nitrate can also burn the leaves. And so that could be a factor as well. So this would be one of these cases where if you really want this tree, you should probably give it bottled water. Can you imagine doing that for a large palm tree? And spider mites are a problem on them as well. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if thrips can be a problem. So I just don't have a palm species that I recommend indoors that gets big. And this is the thing. People are looking for the big dramatic palm look. And that's why they probably chose this one. I'll bet you they paid at least several hundred dollars for this specimen, would be my guess, because these are not cheap. The Erica palms, likewise, just one thing after another goes wrong with them. I just don't find that there are any palms that are going to give you that big tropical indoor look that you're after without a lot of problems. I think you'll be happier with a Dracaena of some sort or something like that, a cordylline, something in that group. A little more desert looking, unfortunately, but at least they're easier to grow in general. Yeah, so the fishtail palm is one that has, it had problems in San Diego. And here you throw in high temperatures, low humidity, and groundwater that's not good quality. It's just not going to look good. So my suggestion was go buy a different palm tree. You're not going to be able to solve this problem.
So, Don, what kind of things are you harvesting and planting this month?
Oh, I would have harvested six ripe tomatoes.
Would have harvested. Now,
Yeah.
my mother was a grammarian. I understand the construction of that. What happened?
The turkeys got them.
Oh, no. Are you going to sell turkeys pretty soon?
What I'm planting in my garden is fencing.
Oh, that's good. That's
I've
good.
learned a lot about how to manage turkeys, but we unfortunately had put up some fencing, which funneled them through the garden, fine, except they stopped at the edge and there were six ripe tomatoes. And for
Oh.
whatever reason, I've never had this problem before. For whatever reason, they ate every one of them. And so now they know tomatoes are edible. So now this means war. So we have lots of people planting zinnias. Great time to plant zinnias. It's a great time to plant China asters if you can find them. Dahlias can still go in right now. These are all things that give nice, big, bold colors in the garden and draw all kinds of beneficial marigolds. Of course, you can continue to plant. Cosmos can go in now. Sunflowers, they're in full bloom in the fields, but you can still plant them in your garden as late as mid-July for bloom 7 or 8 weeks later. If you are a photographer and you're in the Davis-Dixon woodland area, there's a couple of big sunflower seed growers that plant heavily between Dixon and Woodland on the west side of both of those towns. If you head up one of the main roads, like Pedrick Road, right now, the fields are in full bloom. Spectacular at the moment. Couple notes. They would like you not to walk out into the field. Beehives out there, it's wet because they're irrigating heavily. And of course, these are farms. They use pesticides on them. So you can pull over on the county road, and your zoom lens will do a great job of catching the picture. I will give you one little hint that I've learned the hard way. Sunflowers face east. So try to do it early in the day, and they're at their peak of bloom right now. So this is a great time to get some pictures of the big, 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 big fields of sunflowers that are being grown locally. And people often ask me what exactly they're doing with them. Are they growing them for food or something? They are creating hybrid seed. So you'll notice that each field is 10 or 12 rows of big sunflowers interspersed with three or four rows of much shorter sunflowers. The shorter ones are predominantly male. The other ones are predominantly female. So they're basically creating with a male parent line and a female parent line, F1 hybrid seed. So these are growers who are selling to people that sell seed mostly overseas. Most of it is exported and it's mostly grown for oil. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.